We welcome now Brian Hurlburt back to the show. He's the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture here in Connecticut. And there were several farms that were heavily impacted by recent flooding here in our state. And so we wanted to get a checkup on what happened, what's going on, what this means for those farms, and how our state is helping out with this. Brian, welcome back. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much. Devastating. Devastating to see what some of these farms are going through. I know you were up in Glastonbury earlier this week with the governor. Talk to us about some of the damage. What does the aftermath kind of look like for some of these farms from the recent flooding?
Yeah, and just so your listeners are aware, who may not have been paying as much attention to what's happening in the northwest corner in central Connecticut, the pretty extreme rain events last week up in Vermont as well, you know, all of that funnels down through the Connecticut River Valley. And the river valley and the river was projected to flood. For perspective, the flood level is when the river reaches 16 feet. And the floods that we had seen last week, the river reached depths of 21 feet. So that's 5 feet over the flood stage. That's a lot of water, carrying a lot of debris coming through the Connecticut River Valley. And it jumped the banks in numerous places. The Connecticut River Valley has some of the finest soils in the world. We're very fortunate in that aspect. And flooded a lot of crops. And the timing of this is really unfortunate because in July is when we start seeing, as I know, Melissa, you're probably getting out and about to your farmers markets and farm stands. You're seeing a lot more produce out there than you did, you know, a few weeks ago.
Certainly.
Everything's coming into season, right? Everything's ready for, you know, starting the early picking. And so farmers have invested through their time, energy, labor, fuel, you know, seed costs, fertilizers, to get those crops into the ground and to get something ready for harvest. And then the floods come in at this time, and it erases all of that productivity. It prevents that crop from being picked. So we are estimating, and we have a loss form out there, and I suggest if any of farmers are listening right now to report your losses, or people encourage farms to report their losses through that website. But we're estimating about 2,000 acres of damaged lands across the state from the Connecticut River Valley. We know that that estimate will likely grow a little bit because we have some flooding from the northwest corner that hasn't been reported, and over $20 million worth of lost product. So it's a pretty significant event that we're trying to help farms deal with and recover from.
Would you say, Brian, from some of the flooding, for example, again, I'm glad that you mentioned that a lot of this trickles down from northern states, because I don't know if people do realize the impact of like what went on in Vermont and how that did literally have a domino effect on Connecticut. But what does this sort of mean? Like, are there farms this morning out of commission? Are there farms that are in dire need of help? Because if they don't, they're going to have to shut down. Like, where are we sort of at in regards to how bad is the situation?
It's pretty significant. It's for individual farms. It is pretty significant. I will say that the men and women that I have spoken to that have reached out to the agency, some directly to me, some directly to our staff and our team members, they're tenacious. They're saying, okay, what are we going to do next? How are we going to manage through this? And so that is uplifting that they're continuing to think about, okay, what do we need to do to get that land back into production? What do we need to do to help move that water? And how can we keep supplying Connecticut residents with some of the finest produce that is available at this time of year? There's some thinking going on. Some farms are making hard decisions about, you know, what they're going to do with their staff and how long they can keep their staff on. They're talking to their, if they're a wholesaler, they're talking to their buyers and saying, okay, you know, I'm looking to find some, where I'll have some crops available, in a month. Can we work on that? I will say the farming community is really tremendous in this state. We had a number of farms that have posted their challenges, and a number of other farms have donated crops to them. So they'll, you know, like we were at Killam and Bessette earlier this week with the governor. A farm in Cromwell donated 6,000 pepper plants to them.
Oh,
and,
that was
and
sweet.
That farm can now plant those peppers. They'll have product. You know, they need product to fill out their farm stand in the farmers markets that they go to. They'll fulfill their orders. You know, moving product, planting product means that planting those plants means that they'll be able to keep their staff on and have them do, you know, something constructive for the farm during this period. So that's not the only story that I've heard of that connectivity happening out there. But it's really important to acknowledge the generosity and the thoughtfulness that this community is extending to each other in this time.
So, again, we're talking to Brian Hurlburt, who is the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture. We're talking about farms that are impacted here in Connecticut by the recent flooding, not just here in our state, but also just in the Northeast in general. Brian, give people an idea, because I always think this is such a fascinating factoid that people don't realize. How significant are our farms? How much money do mm-hmm. they bring in? How much do they impact not just Connecticut, but the surrounding, you know, states or even the country? Like, give us an idea.
Yeah. Well, and I think everybody in the state has a farm that they like to go to for apple picking or to pick out their pumpkins or visit at a farmer's market. When you aggregate all those individual farms together, we have 5,500 farms in the state of Connecticut. They employ 22,000 people at those farms. They work 370,000 acres of land, and 70,000 of which is in Long Island Sound in our oyster beds and clam beds. And it generates $4 billion to the state's economy. So, you know, each one of those small businesses, you know, employs a couple people, some, you know, employ 50, 60 people. But when you put it all together, it's a pretty significant industry for a small state like ours that people don't traditionally think of as an ag state.
Yeah, I think people don't realize that Connecticut has such a significant farming industry. And in ballpark, Brian, because I don't want to put you on the spot this early in the morning, but how many farms would you say on average were impacted just by this recent flooding? Not since COVID, because we know a lot have been impacted in the mm-hmm. last several years. But just in this stint in July, how many farms would you say are really in dire need of, like, I know federal funding might be on the table at some point. Mm-hmm. They need support right now. How many would you say?
I would say from the flooding between the northwest corner and the Connecticut River Valley, we're probably looking somewhere between 50 and 100. Wow. If you look at, you know, what's happened this entire year, and you know, I think some of us say, boy, this has been kind of a crazy weather year, right? You know, we had and I just want to put the chronology out there for people. So we had a very mild winter. And in February, we hit 50 degrees in parts of the state. The next day, in those same parts of the state that hit 50 degrees, we had negative temperatures. So that swing is very traumatic on plant growth. And we lost a lot of potential, a lot of the potential peach crop then. Then things kind of proceeded as normal, and the spring was actually looking pretty good. And in fact, because it was a moderate winter and the temperatures were all right, we were actually looking to be about a week or two ahead of where we would normally be in May in the season. And then we had on May 18th a deep frost freeze in the 20 degrees across parts of the state. And so a lot of our berry crop and tree crop, you know, orchards and stone fruits were impacted by that frost freeze because they had been growing and were at a very fragile time in their development where they were budding and the frost killed the buds. And once you kill the bud, you're not going to get a fruit off that potential bud. And you don't get a chance to, you know, restart and get another cycle out of that.
Mm-hmm.
After we got out of May and June, we were talking about declaring a drought status. You know, we had received very little rainfall across the state. And the farms that we were visiting between last week and this week, 2 weeks ago, they were irrigating. They were, putting water onto the crop to make sure that the water, that the plants could sustain the drought status. And now we're in a flood stage. So, in just over 7 months, we've run from, extreme temperatures to extreme droughts to floods. Yeah. And that creates a lot of challenges in planning for a farmer who relies on the weather patterns for their productivity.
Mm-hmm. So Brian Hurlburt is here. He's the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture in Connecticut, and we just got a snapshot of what's happening for dozens of farms here in Connecticut after flooding concerns and many other weather pattern-related issues that they've been facing. So, Brian, a lot of us don't have millions of dollars. A lot of us don't even have thousands of dollars to give. Unfortunately, I know we're going to have a lot of people going, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? We can't control the weather. So what can a person like me or a listener do to support our farms here in Connecticut?
Mm-hmm. Well, Melissa, you're doing one of the best things you can do, and that's using your platform to share out information, make sure people are aware of the situation. So thank you for giving me this time to share out this the story and the current situation.
Of course, it's important.
Across the state here. I think for the listeners at home or in the car, go to ctgrown.org, find a local farmer's market or farm stand to visit. We just heard the weather report. It looks like it's going to be a great weekend. Find a local, pick your own operation, and take the family out and get some blueberries, or go purchase some blueberries from them. And ask, how's everything going at the farm? What are you seeing? And be patient. A lot of the farms in the Connecticut River Valley provide sweet corn for a lot of farm stands across the state. So it's still Connecticut-grown sweet corn, but they just grow a lot of it, and they can move and wholesale it through a lot of farm stands. So there may not be as much at a farm stand because there's just not enough supply like there would be at this time of year in a normal year. So ask, hey, is this sweet corn impacted by the floods, the availability of it? And for those that might not be able to have sweet corn, they're still counting on your support. And so, if you can't buy sweet corn, think about what else you can buy. Ask them for ideas about what the other fruits and vegetables in the farm stand or the market could be used for, and try something new. This is a direct impact on those farms that had water on their fields. But that impact also extends to the farms and the farm stands and farm markets that purchased product from those farms. So being flexible, being able to listen and still getting out there and supporting Connecticut farmers is really important during these challenges.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, thank you so much. And what is the website one more time for people to go and navigate the closest farms to them or to just see which farms are available across the state?
ctgrown.org. That's where people can find a whole bunch of information on the different farms. We've got some recipe sections on there. So it's a great way, if you've got a couple minutes, and I know everybody's maxed out for time, but if you've got a couple minutes, scroll through it, get some ideas, and find a farm around you.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, thank you so much for always being willing to come on WICC. I really do appreciate it. And I keep praying for the farms to just recover. And I do hope that people listening will continue to maybe make the choice of, hey, I could go to a grocery store, but maybe I want to go to a farmer's market instead or incorporate that a little bit more. Just to even make those little changes that could really go a long way in helping keeping our local farms afloat. So thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate the time this morning.
Absolutely. Brian Hurlburt, again, who is the commissioner of the Department of Agriculture in Connecticut, talking about the flooded farms and how we can better support them right here on WICC. So if your eyes are irritated and scratchy, you actually could have dry eye syndrome triggered or made worse by Canadian wildfire smoke. This is actually some national news that I detected earlier this week, and we know that we here in Connecticut have certainly been plagued with the Canadian wildfire skies here in Connecticut throughout the summer. So who better better to talk to about what is going on with your eyes now than our own Dr. Scott Spector, who joins us with this story. Hey, Dr. Spector, how are you?
I'm good. How's everything?
Well, it sounds like we might be having a little bit of trouble with our eyes, but otherwise we're doing okay. Could you tell us, first of all, Dr. Spector, have you seen any of these trends, whether it's dry eye or anything else, due to the wildfires?
Well, you know, like most people, you know, these things come and go, and you just assume, well, there's really not much, you know, not much reason to raise, you know, an excitement level. And, you know, the first I heard of it was like I was stuck in my office. I didn't even know we were having bad air quality. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you start hearing about it, and then the people start coming in and talking about it. And then it becomes brought to the center of attention. And we've certainly seen a lot of people with significant eye complaints, you know, like an extraordinarily large number of emergencies coming in, people with irritation. And the one that was particularly surprising was the number of people developing styes in the last month or so. Just seems unusually large. A large number of people, more so than normally at this time of year. And I think it all boils down to, you know, what we're breathing, and there's actually very, very good data on it. So, for instance, what we're seeing here is not just the smog. What we're experiencing is a lot of particulate matter that is being transmitted through the air. And, you know, one assumes if you're breathing sooty-type air, it will impact your breathing, and it might make asthmatics worse. And, you know, people with bad breathing systems are warned about it. But that material actually gets onto the surface of your eye. And if you wear a face mask, you're protecting your breathing system a little bit, but you're not really protecting your eyes. And if you stay indoors, you're protecting your breathing system, but you're still probably not protecting your eyes. Mm. And so we're seeing this matter sort of causing a variety of different situations. So, for instance, the first thing that you would get is sort of redness and grittiness because you have debris in your eye and in your tear film, and your body doesn't like what's there, so it responds by causing redness and allergic-type symptoms. So people might have swelling. Secondarily, they may just feel, you know, that their vision's not that great because they have, again, debris in their tear film. And I think that what's happening with the styes is the material is getting caught on your eyelashes. And since people, you know, neglect to wash their eyelashes, I mean, they might rinse their face, but they don't use soapy water around their eyes a lot of times. The material stays on your eyelids and then gets into the eye glands and clogs up the glands and causes styes. So I think all in all, you know, we're just kind of living in a, you know, little bit of a, you know, through a, you know, we're living in a mist, and that mist has particles in it. And they, you know, the research that I was mentioning tends to come out of, you know, countries that are known for their smog, like, for instance.
Oh, interesting. I was wondering, I was like, you know, because honestly, when you talk to our meteorologists, we have never really experienced this kind. I mean, we've had the smoky air from the Canadian wildfires, but I mean, you remember, Dr. Spector, it was weeks ago, maybe a month or so, when it looked like we were on Mars. I mean, it was orange outside. We've never really experienced that.
When you drove home, you know, you were looking at the sun, and you were looking, you know, at it through a haze, and
exactly,
it had this kind of you around it. Absolutely, I agree. But the cities that live with this every single day are like, you know, in India and New Delhi, they have great research on the size of the particles and the effect that those particles have in cities in China like Beijing and other, you know, crowded Asian countries. This kind of smog and you know, particulate matter in the atmosphere is common. So that's where most of the real research comes from, is what it's like to have eyes like that in communities like.
Talking to Dr. Scott Spector, if you feel like your eyes have been bothering you this summer, you're not crazy. You know, what's interesting, Dr. Spector, is every winter, I feel like you and I talk about dry eye. That's when we typically see this problem really arise for people living here in Connecticut. But it does seem to be popping up more than it usually would in the middle of the summer. And so for things like dry eye or sty, for example, what are some common treatments and what are some prevention measures? What should we be doing? Like you mentioned, washing our eyelashes, for example. I don't think that's something people commonly do.
Well, I think that, you know, we don't often recommend things like eye wash, but I think if you are, if you work outdoors and you feel gritty, you are gritty. And so you probably want to be really soaping up the eyelids and eyelashes because you want to get this debris off your lashes. And if you want to take it a step further, you can either use, some form of eye drop that's, considered a teardrop, like something. There's a variety of different brands. And with what went on a few months ago with contaminated eye drops, be careful. I would recommend the name brands as opposed to the generics. So like something like Systane or Optive or Tear Care, things like that are good options. And then there's also Bausch & Lomb just makes a simple eye wash, and which is just really what we call balanced salt solution. It's a little bit of salt mixed in with water. And it's sterile, and you can actually use that to rinse out debris from inside the eye. But I think a couple of drops of that, and then prior to showering, would be a good way of cutting back on the amount of material that's left in the eye or on the eyelids. Secondarily, if it becomes problematic, then we can treat it. Not only with lubricants, but we can actually use a slight anti-inflammatory. A mild cortisone drop to cut down on the inflammatory reaction that's associated with this essentially chemical attack on your eyes.
Yeah, some really great pointers there. And Dr. Spector, we always appreciate getting your expertise. Of course, Dr. Spector is located right here in Norwalk. What is your website, Dr. Spector? If anybody ever wants to call you for help with their eyes and for any reason, where can they find you?
So we're in Norwalk. My phone number is 203-853-9900, and my website is spectereye.com.
Simple
enough.
And
again, we have a lot of little tricks up our sleeves, but again, prevention is the best treatment.
Certainly. And Dr. Spector, really appreciate getting your expertise on this. Thank you so much, and I know we'll be talking again soon.
All right. Melissa, take care. Keep your eyes clean. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. You too. So I think it was about a year ago that I had Jeremy in studio with us, and he is the CEO and founder of Said Med. And it's essentially like a toilet lift, which to me, I had brought this up, I think, to Jeremy the last time he was in studio with me. This was something that I had seen on a very popular Netflix show, Grace and Frankie. It was something that they had also created. And I thought, this is brilliant. I hope somebody does this. And then all of a sudden, weeks later, this man walks into my studio and I'm like, oh my gosh, this had to have been based on you. So Jeremy Bronin is back, the CEO and founder, because we've got quite the update for you with Said Med. So good morning to you, Jeremy. Welcome back. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Here, let me fix your microphone here.
Oh, yeah.
I did a horrible job of setting you up. There we go. Hello, hello. Thanks for coming in studio. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. It's funny. We talk about it often, but I did not think I was going to become a toilet entrepreneur, but here we are.
I mean, it's really incredible. So first of all, it was founded 3 years ago out of UConn Mechanical Engineering School. So, I mean, tell us a little bit about how you even came up with the idea of sort of this innovative way to really make it easier to go and leave the bathroom, which is super, super common for really, I would think, most people.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a business partner, I had a business partner who was living with a woman who suffered from a stroke. Mm. She struggled to get around the house, get on and off the toilet. And then he was like, we got to do something. So him and I teamed up, started with one iteration and, 3 years, 9 iterations of the product later, realizing how big of a problem this is for a lot of people in terms of injuries and even financial burden, and said, yeah, let's do it. Let's launch this thing. So we've interviewed a lot of people, about 1,000 customer discovery interviews to, you know, kind of tune in the product to where it is today. And that's got us to where we are.
So very exciting. And how exactly does it work, Jeremy? Like, so if I've got a regular, you know, good old fashioned toilet, how does this work where your product comes in? Do you have to replace the entire unit? Do you add something to it to create the lift? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, so super simple. It's essentially a glorified toilet seat. So it just replaces the existing toilet seat. So there's only two bowls in the back of every toilet holding that on. And you just pop those two out, the seat out, and put ours in, and then it lifts up to 80% of your weight, slowly lowering you down and then lifting you off with no electricity, no motor, no wiring to an outlet in a bathroom.
How? I mean, I have to ask that question. How are you not plugging something in to make this work?
Yeah. So it's a gas spring. So same thing you might find in like a car trunk or a porch screen door that we mechanically optimized with our system.
Wow. Okay. That's incredible. And it seems like the installation is not too bad. It seems like it's easy to do.
Yeah. I've been timed installing it in 2 minutes. So it's pretty
really?
Quick. Yeah.
Wow. So you guys hit the marketplace this week.
Yes. We just launched. We're now available for pre-order on our website.
That's amazing. And I know you had said, and Jeremy's kind of a young guy. I could say that because I'm also young in this room and we are looking at each other and I'm like, oh, okay, we've got to be maybe a few years off from each other. I don't know. But you never thought you'd get into this sector for entrepreneurship. What have you learned, though, in 3 years, especially with, you know, you said you've gone through a lot of prototypes. It's been a lot of back and forth to get to this point. Are you satisfied with what you've learned and the fact that you've now created something that's really going to help people? I would think your demo is like 65 plus, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. Well, it's both older adults and people with disabilities.
Sure,
absolutely.
Sure.
Am I satisfied? Yeah. I mean, I think that the coolest thing is not only did we launch this company and it's exciting to do and, you know, building a business is fun, but, you know, getting up in the morning knowing that I'm working on a company and a product that literally is helping people. And I already have people that are using the product and loving it and telling me how it's reducing pain and helping them. I mean, that's why I get up out of bed in the morning, and it just fills me with a lot of joy. You know, it lights the fire within me.
Yeah, sure. And again, we're talking to Jeremy Bronin, who is the CEO and founder of SedMed. What does SedMed mean? I don't think I asked you that the last time you came in.
Yeah, so it was short for Sedentary Medical Solutions, as in sedentary having to do with sitting.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Okay, very, very clever. And do you have to, I mean, is it very easy to use, Jeremy? So once you install this mm-hmm. seat, is it very simple to use? You don't really have to, like, you know, maintain it or change it, or do you have to replace it? Like, what is sort of that process, I guess, for people learning how to use it, but also maintaining it?
Yeah, there's no maintenance actually to it. It's very simple. Once you have it on there, you literally just sit back against it. It kind of catches you, slowly lowers you down, giving you resistance.
Wow.
It automatically locks for safety. And then when you're ready to get up, you just unlock it and you'll feel about a nice, gentle, but efficient boost of like 80% of your weight coming off that you're in control of.
Wow.
So there's not really much to it. It's a simple product in terms of use.
That's amazing. And as far as from the reviews you've gotten from people, they feel like it's done a lot of help.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the coolest and best part so far. Talking to the actual people that are using it and saying, like, this is like a life changer is it's been really, really great. And I'll say this also, we're not done, right? We just continuously look for how can we make it better, because that's how we make the best possible product that helps the most people.
I was going to ask you, Jeremy, what's kind of like down the line now for you? Like, what is your next venture that you're working on?
I don't know if I'm on to the next venture yet as much as I love this space. I think that people who struggle with activities of daily living, older adults, people with disability, it's a totally underserved market of people that don't have enough innovation for them and their mobility needs. And, you know, we're looking at other things such as a smart toilet, which is funny, to track, you know, data and usage and fall detection and alerting 911.
That's huge.
Yeah. So.
I mean, that is that I hate to say it, but my grandmother, who has since passed, she has every time she fell which was only a few times, but it was always in the bathroom because she she lived in, I mean, she was living at our house, but she had an in-law apartment. And, you know, thankfully she had the alert button, you know, around her neck. But sometimes she would take it off and leave it on our bedside and it would just be in the middle of the night. I got to get up and go to the bathroom and boom, she's on the floor. And there was no way of her contacting us. That's huge to have that kind of innovation. That's something you're working on.
Yeah, yeah. And well, I'll say two things quickly. One, people 85 and older suffer more than half of their injuries, 50% near the toilet. So it's a big problem area. But also, anybody out there, either, you know, maybe you're an older adult or you have a loved one, get a nightlight in the bathroom and in the bedroom. It really is important for safety.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it makes my product obsolete. You know, like we need more safety.
I agree.
And more solutions.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And I'm a huge nightlight fan. I have them all over my house. But that's because I'm scared of the dark. That's a totally different thing. But it makes a lot of sense. How much does your seat go for, Jeremy?
Yeah. So it's $1,200. But our pre-order price right now is $900.
Oh, wow.
So good $300 off, right? We're a premium product.
Mm-hmm. And so you said right now you can only pre-order online, right? You're not paired with other stores or anything like that?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So what is your website?
Sed-med.com. So that's a sed and then hyphen med.
All right. SED-MED.com.
Yep.
Simple as that. And when people order, are you guys like stocked up? Are they able to get it pretty quickly? Or like what does the turnaround time look like?
We're estimating quarter one of 2024 is when we'll get them in. We're actually doing a lot of life cycle quality control testing now to make sure we're delivering the best possible product. So
okay.
We're in that production phase.
So we're talking about we won't even really see these seats installed till next year.
Yeah. We have some now that we've been testing and selling a little bit. But our big batch comes then.
That's exciting. And are your reviews also on your website so people can, you know, just do a little bit of research, look it up or anything like that?
Not yet, but we're definitely going to be putting those on shortly.
That's exciting. So again, sed-med.com if you are interested in pre-ordering this really, I think, innovative way of going to the bathroom. Like I said, I can just remember when my grandmother was alive how much anxiety she had with when we go out to dinner or something. She never wanted to drink too much because she knew she'd have to go to a bathroom she wasn't familiar with. And it was like just knowing the pain of sitting down and having to get up was so awful. And you could see it on her face how much she hated it. And so many people don't like that and don't look forward to it. I know even for myself, when I have a bad workout, or it's a great workout, but I wake up and I'm so sore because I didn't stretch or something. The one thing I regret is I'm like, oh, I really hope I don't drink a lot of water today because I don't want to have to sit down and get up. It hurts. So I think this is such a fantastic product you have made. And if people want to learn more information, again, sed-med.com. And Jeremy, thank you for coming up with this and for pursuing it and for sticking with it and wanting to do more and continue this product on.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks for letting me come on my favorite radio station.
Oh, shucks. Now I did not ask him to say that, but I don't know who did. If somebody in the hallway told you to say that, I appreciate it. You're very sweet. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much. Continued success. And thank you for sharing your story here on WICC.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate you.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
So, Greg, it's Zookeeper's Day. And, of course, everyone's favorite guy at Connecticut's only zoo is on the, you know, in the hot seat today. We want to know what it's like to do your job, what it really means to be a zookeeper in today's world, and how has it changed maybe over time. So, hello, Greg. How are you?
Oh, good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, actually, it's Zookeeper Week. It's not even Zookeeper Week.
Now, listen, I stand corrected. I am so sorry. It is Zookeeper Week.
If really honest, it's Zookeeper.
Just slapped myself on the wrist for that one. I can't believe it. It should be Zookeeper Day every day.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And one of the things that it's interesting because I've been working here now for many, many years, and now as the zoo director, you know, since about 43 years ago, people still call me the zookeeper, right? And they say, hey, there's a zookeeper. And I'm like, well, I'm the zoo director. And that's not being egotistical. That's saying that I don't really work with the animals anymore. A zookeeper actually works with the animals. A zoo professional. Actually,
I was just going to say that. So do you guys have a zookeeper? Do you guys have zookeepers?
Zookeepers are all of our animal care professionals that work with the animals. Those are zookeepers.
Okay.
So a lot of times the title gets kind of mixed up a little bit and say zookeeper, like I'm keeping the zoo, like as a general zoo. But a zookeeper actually takes care of the animals. They're the ones that
work. Could you be a zookeeper, though, Greg, if you wanted to?
I started out as a zookeeper.
That's what I thought.
And I worked with the animals here at the zoo, and that is something that, you know, the reason I got into this business was because I wanted to work with animals. I wanted to, you know, to have a direct connection with animals. And the staff that I have here are a really special, you know, breed, no pun intended, because they, 7 days a week, rain or shine, the storms we just had a couple of days ago, they're out there in the rain working with the animals. You know, if it's cold, if it's hot, you know, whatever the conditions are, they have to take care of our animals here at the zoo. So that means they are the zookeepers. They are the ones that take care of those animals. And it's so important because not only are we working with some of the most endangered species of animals on the planet, but we're also animals that need care every day, you know, and something like as a pet, but these aren't pets. There are keepers here do not look at our animals as pets. They look at them as somebody who needs their help. And every day, 7 days a week, you got to clean, you got to feed, you got to maintain those animals. Now, you mentioned how it's changed over the years. Well, years and years ago, you had to have a love for animals anyway. You had to have respect for animals. I like to say respect for animals more than love for animals, because you have to respect what they are. You have to give them what they need to be what they do naturally. But years ago, you just didn't have the tools that we have today. Years ago, we were just getting into what diets mean. You know, well, you give an animal, a meat eater, you give them meat, right? You give vegetables to the animals, you give some, but there was really no weighing of the diets. There was no checking the diets with a veterinarian or checking the diets with a nutritionist and making sure that those diets were exactly what those animals need. Now that's exactly what they do. When they give an animal a diet, whatever animal, let's say the spider monkeys, they weigh the diet before they put it out. They weigh it when they get it back to see what they've eaten, what they've consumed, making sure that they're getting enough food. And if they're eating all their diet, then they go to the veterinarian and to our curatorial staff and say, okay, we need more food for the animal because they seem to be, you know, consuming it all. And that way we make sure that the animal's getting what they need. And that's what we're doing with our baby otters right now. Every week we increase the diet to the otters. That is something that as a staff is watching them as they grow, you know, how what their needs are.
Mm.
And also now we're talking about research, learning about our animals. Back then, you know, it was really making sure that we had the resources to take care of the animals correctly. But really learning about them really wasn't part of what we did. Now, research is very, very important. Learning about how we can take care of those animals better.
Yeah.
Working with students that are doing the research here. And then applying that to the animals, applying that how you can, you know, enrich our animals' lives here
right.
at the zoo.
Well, and Greg, so you know, you bring up a great point, because one of the things I wanted to ask when it comes to Zookeepers Week is how the role of a zookeeper has changed over time. I mean, the world is different in 2023 than it was even 20, 30 years ago.
Right. And it's back then, the animals were here. Yeah, we took care of them. And, you know, and we made sure they were as healthy as we possibly make. Our veterinarian back then, now our veterinarian comes in once or twice a week. Back then, it was maybe once a month.
Wow.
We had a great veterinarian, Dr. Hockman, who had worked with us for many, many years. And
change, Greg? I mean, once to twice a week makes sense, but why once a month? Why was it that way?
Well, because we didn't, you know, it was more, it's more right now is preventive medicine.
Interesting. Not, okay, sure,
yeah,
sure.
We're not looking at coming in if there's an animal sick. What you're trying to do is prevent those animals being
right.
sick. Prevent,
oh, interesting,
making sure,
sure
that on a day-to-day basis, doing blood work, doing fecal examinations,
okay.
you know, just doing
That's
regular
great.
Examinations, walking around the zoo and walking into every area and working with our staff. Well, again, the animal care staff are working with these animals on a day-to-day basis, so they know what's going on. And if they see something that's a little off, and that's something, as soon as you see something's a little off, that's the zookeeper's job is to then say, okay, let's nip this in the bud. Let's get these animals ahead of it. Exactly.
Wow.
Well, so we've had our staff in the last few years have raised, especially in our animal predator area, with our Amur leopards, our Amur tigers, which they hand reared these animals. That's a 24/7 job.
Yeah.
You know, when we had to hand rear the babies when the moms didn't take care of them correctly. And now I think we mentioned a few weeks ago that Rika is one of our tigers. She just had a baby. And now that because we had a baby here, we were able to keep that baby alive when mom rejected it. Now she's had babies of her own. So it's exactly what we're trying to do within the context of our facilities, of our zoos, is keep these animals going on our planet. And so for an animal that, if we didn't have her going, we wouldn't have had those two cubs now born to keep the bloodline going well. So again, that's part of the job is looking at the conservation. We have staff that go out on conservation programs. Our zookeepers will go out and do conservation programs outside of the zoo. So it's really a great thing, and they belong to the American Association of Zookeepers, which is their own little organization that really pushed hard years ago in 2007 to get a resolution passed to make this actually Zookeeper Week. So it is a House resolution that was put in to show that there's a dedication from these individuals, you know, to appreciate wildlife and nature, not
yes.
only in what we have in the zoo, but also to get that education and that environment out there. Back when I first started here, we didn't have time to talk to people. We were just doing our job really as much as we could.
Right, you put now, your head down and do your job. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right now, our zookeepers, our animal care professionals, will talk to our guests.
Yes.
And I get that all the time from people that that visit our zoo, that they feel that when they come in here, if they see a zookeeper working, they can ask us questions, and the staff will take time to talk to them and tell them what they're doing and give that information out. So I feel that makes our zoo, again, a little more intimate than a lot of the other bigger facilities that we have in the country.
I agree. You've got a great staff there, Greg, and we tip our hats to the zookeepers, not just at the Beardsley Zoo, but across the country, who are doing such great work for these animals and conservation and educating. Really, it has changed over time, but it's really beautiful to see how even just learning from zookeepers was something that you couldn't do even in the 90s. And so I appreciate you highlighting that, and please thank all of your zookeepers from all of us here at WACC for the work that they do. We appreciate them.
Thank you. And I think they appreciate everybody else also.
Well, I appreciate you as well. I don't want you to feel excluded, Greg. You know how much I love you. You know how much I love you. So thank you. Zookeeper Week.
Alrighty.
I stand corrected.
Zookeeper Week.
All right, Greg.
And they're having, it's pizza day today.
Oh, well, there you go. All right. So I did call you on the right day. So that's good. Got pizza. They're celebrating at the Beardsley Zoo. And we so appreciate all the work that Connecticut's only zoo does, which is at the Beardsley Zoo right here on WICC. Thank you, Greg. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.